This is the son of PCJ.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, for the weekend of February 2nd. Yes, the first show of February. I can't imagine that just a few weeks ago we actually became, well, 2013. And the year's already flown by so quickly. Well, the month of January has in any case. Keith Powell here with you for the next little while of some music, as well as our continuing look at the history of Radio Nederland, the Dutch International Service, with a special program that was produced by Piet Myers for their 50th anniversary. And today we bring you part three of that program. Now, first, let's kick off with a little bit of music. Now, I know that many of you out there, a number of you anyway, say that, well, Keith, you don't play enough classical on the program, and maybe you should do that a little bit more often, since you play so many different types of music, everything from, well, easy listening to rock and roll to heavy metal and pop and everything else in between. So what about classical? And I admit, you're right. You know, we haven't really played enough. So I thought that today we'd begin with, without a doubt, one of my favorite recordings of all time. The composition is by British composer Vaughan Williams, who died in 1958. A lot of his music, of course, well, was very connected to the United Kingdom and has a very, very English sound. We're going to take a listen to The March from the English Folk Song Suite, and it's called March Folk Songs from Somerset. And it's performed by the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, directed by Yuri Meyer. And like I said, this is one of my favorite recordings of that composition.
Thank you.
The Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, directed by Yuri Meyer, playing Vaughan Williams' composition, Folk Songs from Somerset, from the English Folk Song Suite, beginning today's edition of Happy Station. Now, while it is normal, let's say, if you send something by post, to take some time. Of course, I mean, it's not like email. You don't just drop it in a box and then it arrives there, you know, instantaneously. We haven't arrived at that point yet, except with email. Maybe one day they'll invent like a teleporter or something like we see on Star Trek for mail services. I think one of the first countries that should employ that kind of service would be Canada Post. And I'll explain why. Now, here at PCJ, we get mail from practically all around the world. Even in some countries that are, well, some people would say really remote and very remote places. Now, the longest we've ever had to wait for a letter from a very remote country was 6 weeks. And what that was actually was, I'll explain to you. We had sent something to the Voice of Korea in North Korea, just a little thank you card for continuing to send us copies of the Pyongyang Times, which they've been sending us now for, oh, more than 2 years. And it takes about 6 weeks from when it's sent from Pyongyang in North Korea to arrive here in Taiwan. Most of the mail that we get and CDs and other packages that come from the United States take roughly 7 to 10 days. 14 days, if it's really long. Australia, around the same amount of time. Europe, around the same amount of time. Japan and other parts of Asia, between 5 to 7 days. But for some reason, there is one country in the industrialized world that it takes a lot longer from. And that country is Canada. Yes. And I can give you two of the most recent examples, because there's actually quite a few. Last August, 2012, I bought an LP from a retailer in Ottawa, Canada. He actually sent it the following day, had the tracking number and everything. Well, 4 weeks went by, and I was thinking, well, this is taking a little bit longer than what I expected. Check the tracking number. There was no data information. Let another week go by. Contacted Canada Post. Gave them the tracking number. They said, we're unable to track it at this time. Maybe there's a problem with the tracking number. There wasn't a problem, because what I had was an exact scanned copy of the form that was used to fill out to send it out. Well, more time went by. And actually, at one point, I really just forgot about it. And then on December 25th, yes, December 25th, that's August, September, October, November, December, 5 months later, it arrived. Another recent example was from Mike Page, who lives in Toronto, Canada, who sent me something on November the 15th. It arrived, I couldn't believe it, January 25th. Every time, and I have so many other examples of these things, but every time there's something that comes from Canada, it takes forever. So what happened? You know, Mike lives in Toronto. What happened? He brought it to the post office, you know, got the stamp and the customs form on it, handed it to somebody. They then took the package, attached it to the leg of a pigeon, who then flew to the west coast of Canada, which took some time, of course. When it arrived on the west coast of Canada, they decided to load it on a very old fishing boat, the kind of fishing boat that only has a 3-horsepower engine, maybe even a steam engine, a very small steam engine. It then chugged its way down to the Pacific. it actually has stamped on the package the route that it went. So it actually went from Toronto. It flew, of course, out of Vancouver. Then it made its way to Japan, from Japan then to Taiwan. But for some reason, there is all this time from when it was in Vancouver, or rather I should say Toronto, to arriving in Japan. It arrived in Japan on January the 21st. I couldn't believe it. I really, really couldn't believe it. Absolutely extraordinary. And this is Canada. And I think I know the reason why. You know, Canada Post is bad. It's just plain bad. I remember, of course, when I was living there and having used Canada Post on a few occasions and thought they were absolutely dreadful. So it doesn't really surprise me. And I'm wondering, of course, if anybody else has had this kind of very slow. And like I said, it's only Canada. Every time we've received something from Canada Post that is sent from Canada, it takes forever. I just don't understand it. Really don't understand it. Anyway, Mike Page did send along a very nice gift, actually. And I have to thank you, Mike, very much because, I mean, of course, everybody always says, you know, it's just what I always wanted. But actually, in fact, it is because I had been looking for one for a couple of years now. You sent one along. It's just a baseball cap that actually has the old Radio-Canada CBC logo on it, which I absolutely adore. I think it's probably one of their best logos ever, the logo they had in the 1940s. So thank you very much for sending that along. And we're going to have a song now going out to you, and I'm thinking, well, let's play something Canadian. And considering how apparently slow it is to get information from here in Taiwan to Canada, we'll play something now. We'll play something now, and you'll probably hear it in 20 years. Okay? No. It is Ian and Sylvia Tyson from Canada with a song that actually was written by Ian Tyson himself called Someday Soon.
There's a young man that I know, just turned 21. Comes from down in southern Colorado. Just got out of the service and looking for his fun. Someday soon, going winning, someday soon. My parents cannot stand him, 'cause he works the rodeo. They say he's not your kind, he'll leave you crying. If he asks, I'll follow him down the toughest road of old. Someday soon, going with him, someday soon. When he visits me, my pa ain't got one good word to say. Got a hunch he was wild back in the early days. So blow, you old northern, blow him back to me. He's likely driving back from California. Loves his damned old rodeos as much as he loves me. Someday soon, going with him, someday soon. Someday soon, going with him, someday soon.
Someday Soon, Ian and Sylvia Tyson, with a song composed by Ian Tyson himself. And there was actually another singer who had a big hit with that song, and that was Judy Collins. That's right. We have to play the Judy Collins version one day. It's also quite lovely. And that's going out to Mike Page in Toronto, Canada. You're listening to your program, Happy Station, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, this coming March will be my fourth year anniversary hosting this show. And we're going to be doing something special about that. But bringing us up to that date, well, we've been running a special series. A series that was produced for Radio Netherlands' 50th anniversary some time back. It was produced by Pete Myers and takes a look at their history. And we're going to run now today part three. Hope you enjoy it.
On April the 15th, 1947, Radio Netherlands, in its definite form, officially became a non-profit-making foundation. Our birth certificate and guaranteed independence was handed to us, and we began the task of establishing ourselves in the highly competitive field of international broadcasting. April the 15th is our official birthday, but in reality, we began broadcasting in the English language 2 months earlier, when the newly created English service was launched. This is the story of that service and our early years. Telling the story of the English department's evolution over half a century is impossible in our limited time, which is why we will do it by the decades. Each of these programs will concentrate on a particular decade, in this case, the pioneering years, the last 3 years of the 40s. In our archive, we discovered a treasure trove of ancient recordings and written material that paint a vivid picture of our beginnings. For instance, we launched ourselves with 20-minute transmissions that later became an hour long. We started with 6 staff members that swiftly increased to include not just English-speaking Dutch presenters, but British, Canadian, American, Australian, and South Africans. Our studios and offices were housed in 4 villas in Hilversum, villas that contained 6 language departments. Right after the Second World War, the Dutch were the first to return to shortwave broadcasting. The other 5 followed in due course, as this clip from the archive illustrated years ago.
The Indonesians were the first edition, opening a section in 1946.
This is Radio Nederland in Hilversum, Holland.
Our English section first took to the air on the 4th of February, 1947.
Esta emisión va dirigida a España y África Española en campos de onda corta de 30, 31 y 49 metros.
And in September of the same year, the Spanish language was first broadcast, followed soon after by transmissions in Afrikaans and Arabic.
U luistert naar het Afrikaanse programma van Radio Nederland en Hilversum.
إذاعة هولندا العربية في هيلفرسوم.
We are naturally more concerned with the operation of the English section and assume that you are too.
You're absolutely right, old boy. You know, looked at from our perspective 50 years on, radio was a great adventure in the old days. None of the technology that exists today to make a broadcaster's life easy existed then. If you went outside the studio to record an interview, you did it on a wire recorder. You then transferred that recording to a disc and prayed silently during transmission that the disc didn't jump. Fortunately, many of those discs still exist, with priceless recordings of celebrated people who've passed into history. So, let's make a selective dip into our treasure box and begin with this.
Here again, the above our clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
The song that's ever associated with American President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Happy Days Are Here Again, which was his campaign song that led America out of the Depression 30s and won him four terms as White House occupant. Throughout his political life, Roosevelt, whose forefathers came from the Netherlands, was actively supported by his wife, Eleanor, who visited Holland in 1948 to receive an honorary doctorate from the University of Utrecht. On that trip, she also addressed women's organizations in The Hague and revealed this family secret.
My husband was deeply conscious of what the people of Holland were doing. And I think both of us had a very special interest in this country because some of our forebears came from here. And we had always had an interest in the Dutch. My husband always took his oath of office, whether it was as governor or as president, on the old Dutch family Bible. I couldn't read it. He could read a few words. But always that Bible was used whenever he took a public office.
Amen to that. Eleanor Roosevelt, one of the most admired women of her time, and a woman who played a major role in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She died in 1962. Now, if one were to visit the Netherlands today, one will notice three prominent street names in any major city: Roosevelt, Churchill, and Eisenhower, the three towering figures who played such a decisive role in the liberation of the lowlands during World War II. However, there is one forgotten hero in our post-war recovery story, and few streets and boulevards are named after him. But without America's George C. Marshall, U.S. Chief of Staff during the war and Secretary of State in 1947, Western Europe's economic recovery couldn't have been possible. This was, after all, a devastated, traumatized, and hungry continent 50 years ago. And with a massive infusion of funds from the United States, he proposed and launched the historic Marshall Plan.
Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos, so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. Any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation, I am sure, on the part of the United States government. Any government which maneuvers to block the recovery of other countries cannot expect help from us.
Thus eliminating the Eastern Bloc's access to U.S. aid. But Holland was a grateful recipient, as this report by a Radio Netherlands journalist captured in April 1948, a few months after the Marshall Plan came into effect.
This is Fat Evans speaking from the quay of the Holland-American Line of Rotterdam, the Netherlands. I am standing in the Custom House shed of the Wilhelmina Quay. Outside, there is a beautiful view of the Rotterdam Harbour. Big steamers are lying in their berths. Gigantic cranes are hoisting their heavy loads high up in the air and sweeping them over to the quays. And between their giant sisters, little tugboats scurry around like water flies. The music you can hear in the background is being played by the Holland American Line Snark Band. Before me is lying the motor ship Nordam, the first ship to arrive in Holland with goods from the United States under the European Recovery Program. More ships will follow, bringing food, machinery and raw materials, thus pumping fresh blood, new life into European industry. Some hours ago, when the Nordam approached the Netherlands coast, it was still pitch dark night. But as soon as the news came through, the Hollanders jumped out of their beds to give the ship a festive reception. Fireworks were shot off in the air, and when the ship turned in at the Hook of Holland, the beginning of the long waterway leading to Rotterdam, floodlights sprang on to welcome her and as a tribute to American generosity and foresight.
What a delightful image. A nation jumping out of bed at dawn to greet a shipload of grain. A month after that ship docked, in May 48, Winston Churchill arrived in The Hague to deliver a speech. Voted out of power in 1945, he was then leader of the British opposition. He had become an early champion of European unity. 2 years earlier, in Switzerland, he had called for a United States of Europe. Now, at a congress in Holland, attended by hundreds of prominent West Europeans, he summed up what progress European cooperation had achieved in its first 2 years.
This is what has actually happened. Great governments have banded themselves together with all their executive power. The mighty Republic of the United States has espoused the Marshall Plan. 16 European states are now associated for economic purposes. 5 have entered into close economic and military relationships. We hope that this nucleus will in due course be joined by the peoples of Scandinavia and of the Iberian Peninsula, as well as by Italy. No one can suppose that Europe can be united on any party or sectional basis, any more than that any one nation could assert an overweening predominance. It must be all for all. Europe can only be united by the heartfelt wish and vehement expression of the great majority of all the peoples in all the parties, in all the freedom-loving countries, no matter where they dwell or how they vote.
Europe, the cradle of Western civilization, has long been a continent of philosophers and visionaries, and one of the least known outside of the Spanish-speaking world turned up on a dusty disk in our vault. As European unity has progressed from vision to reality, and the debate reaches its final stages, it's worth remembering that the issues so intensely argued today are not new. Don Salvador de Madariaga was a Spanish philosopher, author, and committed European. Half a century ago, he was interviewed by this network and asked if political unity of Europe was possible.
Of course it is. It is difficult, but it is possible. I do not believe that we can unify Europe by throwing it into a mold and pressing it, but I do believe that we can unify Europe by tying together the nations of Europe without making any of them lose their separate identity.
That extract from a conversation recorded in the early years of the Cold War ended on an amusing but far-sighted note. The philosopher was asked if there was enough outside pressure to force European unity.
Well, we are getting quite as much pressure from outside as we want from our friend Stalin, and I believe that Stalin is one of the true creators of Europe, and in fact I shouldn't be surprised if some people thought of him as the true creator of the Marshall Plan. Without Stalin, there would have been no Marshall Plan. Without Stalin, probably there would be no Europe. We owe a lot to Stalin, and God may preserve him so he can go on making mistakes.
Oh, mentioning Stalin has brought up another point. The Europe that we've been speaking of so far really is only half of this continent. So can we really speak of a spiritually whole Europe without the nations behind the Iron Curtain?
Certainly not. We must not imagine that we are going to save ourselves this side of the Iron Curtain by throwing to the wolves the other side of the Iron Curtain. The Iron Curtain isn't going to remain stable either. And for this is one reason. Another reason is that everybody knows that Western Europe needs the agriculture of the East of Europe. But the most important reason is that the spirit of Europe requires the spirit of the East of Europe, and we couldn't possibly save ourselves and throw in the others to the dogs and deserve to live on.
Don Salvador de Madariaga. Unfortunately, the name of the interviewer was not listed on that recording, but the details on this next conversation have been noted. But before I elaborate, let me juggle with time and history. In 1989, that symbol of division between East and West Europe, the Berlin Wall, came down with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Madariaga's vision of a united Europe embracing the East is now the next major challenge. On Christmas Day 1989, in what was to be the last major triumph of a long and distinguished career, Leonard Bernstein conducted an unforgettable concert in Berlin, turning Beethoven's Ode to Joy, now regarded as the European anthem, into an ode to freedom.
Freiheit! Betreten feuertrunken, himmlische dein Heiligtum. Deine Zauber binden wieder, was die Mode streng geteilt. Alle Menschen werden Brüder, wo dein sanfte Flügel heilt.
Deine Zauber binden wieder, was die Mode streng geteilt.
Bernstein in Berlin conducting at the end of his life. The flamboyant American composer-conductor first came to Europe in 1947 on a conducting tour. That shocked European audiences. Here, after all, was a conductor who used no baton, used no score, and used his whole body like a ballet dancer. He was 27 years old. During the Dutch stage of his tour, he spoke to Radio Netherlands reporter George Slauser.
Now, another very important question. What is your opinion about American music and the young modern American composers?
Well, I think probably the history of American music is very young now. The country is, after all, very young. It's a baby country. And our culture is in a babyhood state. I think it's only since the beginning of the 30s that we can see the history of American music coming into its own and a kind of music evolving in America, which is truly American without trying to be, which all the composers before the 30s tried very hard to do. In other words, they would form schools and try to write American music with using Indian themes or using Negro themes or using jazz or using Virginian folk tunes or something like that to make a nationalistic music, but that doesn't work. You have to do it unconsciously, and that is beginning to happen now.
There has been, again, some European influence. Do you think so?
Always. There's always been European influence. And now, especially, we have almost all the great European composers living in America. Schoenberg and Stravinsky, Mio, Toch, all of them. And besides that, all the conductors and pianists and violinists who are world famous are Americans now. So that our culture really derives from Europe. But in the sense of our composing, we are now beginning to evolve an American style, which is quite natural.
From Bernstein's most popular musical, West Side Story, that was to explode onto the world 10 years after that interview. As you can imagine, the early post-war years were grey and somber. The Netherlands was preoccupied with rebuilding its shattered infrastructure, and few were in the mood for frivolity and fun. Our early programming reflected that mood, with one exception. And he returned, regular as clockwork, on Sundays.
Is everybody happy? Come on, everybody happy. This means you.
This is the happy station, calling everyone of every nation. Everyone was in the fun. We've got the blues right on the run. Every Sunday at this time, we're feeling good, we're feeling fine. Come join the chorus, sing and tap it. Get the happy station habits.
The happy station man, Eddie Starts, whose cup of tea and goodwill cut through the misery and uncertainty of those days. Reflecting Dutch culture and developments on the national scene was the brief of our first magazine show.
Window on Holland. Today, as the year 1948 is drawing to its close, we open our window to give you a bird's eye view of what happened in the Netherlands this year.
Well, this has been an eventful year for the Dutch. Holland was in 1948 the country of congresses, of constitutional events, but most of all, the country of the royal celebrations.
On May the 12th, in a radio broadcast, Holland's Queen Wilhelmina announced her abdication.
Gaat de toekomst tegemoet, schouder aan schouder met Juliana. God zegene u en mijn geliefd kind.
Saying that the burden became too heavy to bear, the old queen first celebrated her golden jubilee as monarch. And then, on September 4th, 1948, the act of abdication was signed at the Royal Palace in Amsterdam, and the 32-year reign of Queen Juliana began. A Radio Netherlands reporter captured that beginning.
On that memorable Saturday morning, the act of abdication is signed in the Royal Palace at Amsterdam. And while thousands of people stand across from the palace on the Dam Square, the old and the young queen appear on the balcony, from where Wilhelmina announces the signing of the deed in person. Then her daughter makes her first official speech as queen, which she concludes by saying, "Together we will go forward courageously. Long live the fatherland."
Tezamen gaan wij moedig voorwaarts. Leve het vaderland!
Music as ever helped to get rid of those post-war blues. In Holland, the big bands were back. Bands like the Skymasters, the Dutch Swing College, and those old favorites, the Ramblers. And the repertoire, decidedly Yankee.
Hey, Bob, Lieber.
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 Yes, your baby knows.
Now, Matilda Brown, to Logan Dutch. If you can see me, but keep your big mouth shut. Singing, hey, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Hey, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Oh, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Hey, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Hey, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Hey, Bob-a-dee-ba.
Yes, your baby knows. Now swing it, swing it.
The Ramblers Band, affectionately remembered to this day. 1948, the Olympic Games restarted after being abandoned because of the war years. Dubbed the Austerity Olympics, it produced a Dutch sporting legend, the unforgettable Fanny Blankers-Koen. She was 30, mother of two, hated the idea of being separated from her children, and already the world record holder in the high jump and long jump. She competed in neither. Instead, she hit the track in four events. Here in Holland, the entire nation was glued to the radio as Fanny ran her first final, the 100 meters. Our Dutch commentator was there.
En ze zijn prachtig gelijk weg op het ogenblik. En Fanny Blankers-Koen ligt onherroepelijk op het ogenblik op de eerste plaats. Manley ligt 2, heeft een meter achterstand, anderhalve meter achterstand. Fanny Blankers-Koen nog steeds 1. Royale luisteraars, en met 2 meter voorsprong is door de finish heen. En Nederland heeft zijn eerste Olympische...
Winning the first of 4 gold medals and taking her place among the greatest athletes of all time, the fabulous Fanny Blankers-Koen, who became known as the Flying Dutch Mam, the Dutch Marvel, and my favorite phrase... Phenomenal Fanny. And she certainly was. But if one issue preoccupied the Dutch at the end of the 40s, it was the loss of empire. When the station came on the air in 47, Holland was engaged in a colonial conflict with Indonesia. When the war ended, Republican leaders Sukarno and Mohammed Hatta unilaterally declared Indonesia independent. At first, the Dutch government thought it could reassert control over its rich colony, but it soon became clear that resistance was too strong. After protracted negotiations, the Dutch offered Indonesia self-government and political equality in an equal partnership with the Netherlands, but that was refused. In 47, Dutch troops tried to settle matters by force, a conflict that lasted 2 years and went against the tide of public opinion. Throughout this conflict, Radio Netherlands had to tread carefully in its reporting. On the one hand, it didn't want to be seen as a propaganda station, while on the other, it wanted to present the Dutch position, which was coming under increasing criticism. In 48, prior to her abdication, Queen Wilhelmina spoke on Radio Netherlands to assure the world that Holland was not seeking a return to pre-war days.
Colonialism is dead. We do not disown our past, and the proud achievements of bygone days, but a nation must be strong enough to make a new beginning. We shall be strong enough.
A mixed message that was followed by further military operations. As the Dutch got more embroiled in their colonial war, alarm bells began ringing in Washington, and the Dutch Foreign Minister, Dirk Sticker, addressed the American people via Radio Netherlands. As the Dutch government saw it, large parts of the Indonesian archipelago were eager to cooperate in setting up a federal Indonesia, with one notable exception.
Only one group of chauvinistic elements under the influence of strongly extremist and communist pressure objected. These Republican forces have hurt and hampered the building up of Indonesian self-government on a federal basis as a preliminary step to final freedom. It is this destructiveness in the acts and intention of those who now rule the Republic which has forced the Dutch government to act.
In the end, the UN Security Council acted and ordered an end to hostilities, and negotiations were resumed again. In August 49, a roundtable conference opened in The Hague, and after 2 months of hard bargaining, it was all over. The Netherlands finally agreed to grant full sovereignty to its former colony. Speaking through the voice of an interpreter, the Republican representative, Mohamed Hatta, summed up the success of the conference.
On this historic day, the people of Indonesia will sense a feeling of relief. Today, it will be officially announced that colonial might has disappeared from Indonesia. A new order of life is born, based on the Pancasila, the five principles. For 4 years, the Republic of Indonesia has struggled for these principles, comprising the meaning of life for the people of Indonesia, and today, this objective is a reality. The Republic Indonesia Serikat will be based on devotion to God, humanity, nationalism, democracy, and social justice. This is a manifestation that the people of Indonesia desire to live as a nation which stands for humanity, democracy, and brotherhood.
And so, on December 27th, 1949, as the decade drew to a close, Queen Juliana signed the act that formally made the Republic of the United States of Indonesia a sovereign and independent nation, thus ending 300 years of Dutch colonial rule in the East Indies. She ended her speech with these words.
Het is een voorrecht deze daad van overdracht der soevereiniteit te verrichten.
It is a privilege to perform this act of transferring sovereignty before history, or rather in the sight of God, who knows why this cooperation in freedom was not achieved earlier or later, and who knows the failings of generations, but who can also see if this can serve in the plan for the future of humanity. May this be so now.
Thans zo zijn.
Independence for Indonesia, a new reality in the Netherlands. The 40s had been the most traumatic, painful, and destructive decade of the century. For Radio Netherlands, it was a beginning and a challenge to have the voice of this tiny nation heard in the international arena. How we use that privilege, we'll explore in our next chapter, The 50s.
And that was part three of our program, looking at the history of Radio Nederland, produced and presented by the late Pete Myers. You're listening to Happy Station, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. You can always contact us. Our email address is hs@pcjmedia.com. Time now for music. This was a gentleman that actually began his career as a rock and roll singer and then switched directions. His name is Tommy Steele, and here he is with There Once Was a Man.
There once was a man who loved a woman. She was the one he slew the dragon for. say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. I love you more. There once was a man who loved a woman. She was the one he gave his kingdom for. Say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. I love you more. My love is a giant, fierce and defiant, but how can I prove it to you? Ain't got no kingdom, no dragon to back up my bragging. How can I show what I would do? I only know there was a man who loved a woman. She was the one he ate the apple for. They say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. I love you more. She was the one that he took poison for. They say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. I love you more. She was the one he swam the channel for. They say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. Love you more. My love is a giant, it's fierce and defiant, but how can I prove it to you? Ain't got no kingdom, no dragon to back up my bragging. How can I show what I would do? I only know there once a man who loved a woman. Yeah, she was the one he ate the apple for. They say that nobody ever loved as much as he but me. Yeah. I love you more.
British powerhouse entertainer Tommy Steele with There Once Was a Man, featuring the Jeffrey Love Orchestra. Anyway, you're listening to Happy Station. Of course, you can listen to this program again. PCJmedia.com, PCJmedia.com. You'll find all editions on the homepage. And the special program that we did at the end of last year, which is 4 hours long, will remain there for another couple of weeks, and then we'll move it to another section of the website. You can also download that at the same time. We still have time for music. We now go to a request from a listener in Japan, a few, actually, listeners from Japan, that want to hear something from Paul Moret and his orchestra that were very, very popular in Japan. And one of you suggested we play Freedom Come, Freedom Go. Freedom Come, Freedom Go, Paul Moret and his orchestra, that were very popular around the world, especially with their hit Love is Blue. You know, bleu, bleu, l'amour est bleu. Also very popular in Japan. He recorded a number of albums. I think the last few albums that he did were actually recorded in Tokyo for a Japanese label, which are quite amazing to listen to. A lot of fun. Anyway, guess what? Yes, we're out of time again. We're just out of time again. And I still sound, you know, it's funny, I was listening to myself the other day. You know, I was talking to myself. And I told you, you know, recently I had this really bad cold, and I'm still kind of not really out of the woods yet. It's at the point now where, I mean, I feel fine. My fever is gone and everything else, but my head is clogged up like there's no tomorrow. It feels like I, you know, when you fly and sometimes your ears get clogged, that's how it feels. And it's quite uncomfortable. Quite uncomfortable. And I'm taking all kinds of medicine, but nothing really seems to be working. One of our listeners suggested to me that I should try taking butterscotch and whiskey. Well, I don't know about you, but certainly made me forget about the cold that I have. I'll tell you that. I remember a number of years ago, I was doing a voiceover. Well, this is like 20 years back. And I had this really bad cold that was coming on. And the producer said, here, drink this rum and butterscotch and tea. And he said, you'll be fine. Well, I can tell you one thing. I did feel fine. I don't even remember doing the commercial. I really don't. I don't even remember how I got home that day. They just kept, you know, feeding me stuff like, you know, this stuff through the studio door. It was rather funny. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. So long. Au revoir. Auf Wiedersehen. Adios, amigos. And sayonara.